I will be. My name is Howard Luke, Your Honors. I represent Appellant Michael Furukawa. This is a joint appeal.
Yes.
Seated at counsel table are Mr. Keith Shigetomi, the gentleman closest to me. He represents Mr. Dennis Furukawa, and Mr. Furukawa is represented by Mr. Dana Ishibashi. We've decided I will do the argument, unless there's specific questions regarding those other two defendants. Appellants, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Are you reserving any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I am. May it please the court, I would ask for approximately 4 to 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Try to keep track of your own time, and I'll try to remind you.
I have my timer right here, Your Honor.
Okay.
Hope it works. Thank you very much. May it please the court, my name again is Howard Luke. I do represent all the appellants in the conspiracy charge. As the court is well aware, all defendants went to trial over a period of approximately 5 weeks from September 26 to October 27, 2006, were convicted as charged on both the conspiracy as well as the mail fraud counts, were sentenced on October 4, 2007. They were found guilty on the same day that was the last day of trial. There are a number of issues that we raised in our brief, Your Honor, and a number of issues that were raised by Mr. Tong, and we responded in a reply brief. What I'd like to talk about, Your Honors, to begin with, has to do with the mail fraud count in this case. Your Honor, I am asking the court to reverse this case based upon the paucity or lack of evidence pertaining to the mailing of the checks to Mr. Furukawa and also to the other co-conspirators. And I've cited in my briefs the primary case of the United States versus Chung Lo. That's the Ninth Circuit case that was decided by this court, 2000. I would also like to subsume the Third Circuit case, United States versus Hannigan, which is a 1994 case, which is a case that really stands for the proposition, is remarkably close to this case as far as the mailings are concerned. I would submit I am going to speak very briefly about a case that has been cited by the government to stand for the proposition that the evidence of mailing was sufficient. That's the Miller case cited by Mr. Tong. Well, that's a Ninth Circuit case. It was decided in 1982. It seems to me from a reading of a number of these cases, including the cases that were cited by Chung Lo, Your Honors, that there has been some an evolution in the way the appellate courts have looked at the issue of mail fraud. Some of the remarkable comments that we see in the concurring opinion in United States versus Hannigan seem to really admonish the government from trying to just hitch the wagon of the mail fraud charge to the issue or the element of mailing to the fraud itself. As this court said in Chung Lo, there's a real danger that once the fraud is alleged and proved, that the issue of the mailing itself might be minimized in the eyes of the jurors. And I think I don't think anybody would disagree with that. It seems to be almost an afterthought, but as we know, this is what brings these cases within the jurisdiction of the United States government. Your Honor, let's look at some of the evidence in this case. In our case, Sheila Walters was the only witness who testified as to the mailing. She was the head of the pre-audit division of DAGS, which is the Department of Accounting and General Services for the state of Hawaii. She had pretty good knowledge and awareness of the familiarity with summary warrant vouchers, procedures utilized for the processing of payment of the vouchers. I have no quarrel with her testimony regarding those matters, Your Honor. Now, the interesting thing is she testified as to the practices that were current as of October 17, 2006. This is the date of her testimony. She was examined by Mr. Goya, who was the State Attorney General acting as Special Assistant United States Attorney assisting Mr. Tong. She testified only as to the practices that were relevant and current as of that date. Now, the mailings that were alleged in the conspiracy as well as the overt acts really had to do with the mailings that were examined were in the calendar year of 1999, 7 years prior to the testimony of Ms. Walters. Now, what's significant is that Ms. Walters never testified that she was familiar with the procedures that were in effect at the time and the date of the checks in question, which were purportedly the result of processing and routing back in 1999. Moreover, Your Honor, there is absolutely, Your Honors, there is no evidence whatsoever, the record is devoid of any evidence of postage affixed to the any envelope. There's no evidence of any envelope for that matter.
Wasn't there evidence of the actual agency records and the respective warrant routing indicators for the time when these checks were allegedly went out? Weren't they in the record?
Well,
did they comply with her testimony as how those types of things are processed? In other words, what I'm trying to say,
I understand.
She's testifying on, as you said, in 2007.
Right.
As I read the record, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the 1999 records of payment, the routing indicators and all this stuff, were the same type of system that she was testifying to. So records that were produced were the same thing she was doing later on.
That may be true, Your Honor. That may be true. But the interesting thing is, she referred to the famous, I think that's how you pronounce it, FAMIS computer system at the time she testified currently. Now, that might not be a big deal, Your Honor. Granted, maybe now what is computerized was done by hand or by an earlier generation of computer. I think it's possible, and it clearly is possible. Good question, because it's possible, and it would seem to be in compliance with her, in agreement with her, her testimony, that the procedures she was testifying to were familiar to her, and those, the indications of the slash mark, the indications of whether or not the number one was placed into an appropriate box, whether the check was to be delivered or rerouted back to the department, all those things, she seemed to be familiar with that, so you're absolutely right. They may have been occurring.
Well, are you saying that she failed to show a routine custom and practice of that department to mail checks?
I am saying she did testify to a routine custom and practice up to a certain point, but then...
Well, okay, I go along with that. Yes. Let me stop you there, because I want to make sure I understand where you're going. If she showed a routine custom and practice, and then they produced the 1999 documents, and they comply with her idea of what the routine and practice is, what's the problem?
The real problem, Your Honor, is that she brings this check, or she brings a procedure up to the point where a check is generated, and then she testifies that, well, we have a system whereby if the check is to be rerouted back to the department, then one indication is given. The other indication is whether the check is supposed to be picked up by a courier and brought to the post office. That's it. There's nothing about the check being placed in an envelope.
Well, we're not going to get an eyeball witness on the check putting in an envelope. I agree with that. But if you're going to use routine custom and practice, and if the slash through the word mail rather than through the word delivery was there, and if that's part of the routine practice, and do we then have to say, well, that's fine, but now we have to go further and get an eyeball witness on the check in the mail?
I don't think that's necessary, Your Honor. I think the cases are against me as far as putting the check. Absolutely.
Well, you're just saying that the routine custom and practice is not acceptable. Right?
No, that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor.
What are you saying?
I am saying it's fine if the routine custom and practice was not attenuated at the point in which the mail, at the point in which the check was supposed to have been placed in a basket and was supposed to have been picked up by a courier. And we don't even know who the courier is. We don't know if it's a courier from the state of Hawaii. We don't know if it's a messenger service. We don't know if it's a FedEx or UPS person. We don't know if it's a mailman or mailwoman, a delivery person. We have no idea.
So you're saying the check, it shows that the check was processed, it shows that it was to be mailed, but you're saying there's no showing custom and practice of where it went after that.
That's correct. Absolutely correct, Your Honor. But beyond that...
So what do you make of her testimony when she's asked about that point, and they confront her with the exact checks, and she says this, the question, so in this particular case, how were the checks on this document delivered? Answer, mail.
If you look at that excerpt that you're citing to, Your Honor, you will see that I objected. I was overruled. I don't think, with due respect to the trial judge, I think that was an erroneous ruling. I think it should be sustained.
It may be, but I mean, we're looking here at the sufficiency of the evidence. She says she worked there 25 years. She said she had supervisory capacity. She was given the checks, and then she opines on it. Why isn't that enough?
That's not enough. Interestingly,
it's different from Lowe, because
it's different.
They couldn't even show that there was a document.
Right. It's different from Lowe, but it's really, you know, it's slightly different from Lowe because there is no document in Lowe. But I think the government had an even better argument in Lowe than it would have in this case, that if the loan was approved, then obviously the truth in lending document would have been generated and mailed, because otherwise the loan would not have been approved. I think that's really solid circumstantial evidence, Your Honor. In our case, we don't have that. We have a Hannigan case. In Hannigan, the Third Circuit, which was approved of, I believe, by Chung Lo, the court in Hannigan said, well, it was brought to the mailroom. It was brought to the mailroom. I think that an interdepartmental mailroom would more likely satisfy the likelihood of having it being placed in the United States mail than in our case.
That's a good jury argument, and that's a Third Circuit case. And this is a sufficiency of the evidence in this case. And we're supposed to go back and retry to find out whether the evidence was sufficient and outguess the jury when this evidence went to the jury.
It went to the jury.
I mean, all your errors here are all trial and sentencing errors. And the standard review are extremely, they're not in your favor, very frankly, when you're trying to re-argue the case.
Right.
I mean, you're making an argument here for the jury that they shouldn't have believed this. The evidence went in.
Well, Your Honor, you're right. I did make a motion for a judgment of acquittal. One of the grounds was the mailing itself that was denied. It goes to the jury. But I think what we have here is the Chung Lo situation where the jury is looking at the fraud. Well, these guys committed so much fraud, good enough.
Well, whether it's fraud or what, you mean to tell me in a fraud case we're going to have to instruct the jury on differently how they're going to view the evidence? They're going to view the evidence as presented. If the evidence didn't go in, or if the evidence was improper going in, that's one thing. If it's not routine custom and practice, if the documents are not there, huh. But in this case, we have routine custom and practice, documents in, testimony by the person who does the job, the jury makes a decision.
That's true.
I mean, and we're supposed to review that under what standard?
Well, Your Honor, I am asking the court to take a look at the facts that were presented at trial. I would submit that no reasonable juror could have found guilty on a reasonable doubt basis.
And what standard of review do we apply?
I think it's clearly erroneous, Your Honor.
Okay.
Clearly erroneous. I know it's a tough standard, but I mean,
I'm sympathetic to your argument. I'm also looking at it as an appellate judge on what standard of review we have in the nature of what you presented to your appeal.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me just finish up on that. What the government could have done in this case, all they had to do was bring on one or two witnesses to show some evidence that the check, by the way, we know the check was folded. That much we know. It was folded, whatever that means. What we don't know is if it was put in an envelope. Hannigan, we know it was put in an envelope. We don't know if postage was affixed. We don't know if there's a postal meter that stamped the envelope. The chain of inferences is broken at a time where the movement of the check to what was purportedly ending up in the United States mail was broken well before the time it should to make this evidence sufficient for the purposes of finding the defendants guilty of mail fraud. That's my position in this case. I would like to also very briefly talk about there was an interesting concurring opinion in the Third Circuit case citing United States versus Burks. And what the Burks case, I don't mean to get too far from the geographical location of where we are. This is, again, a Third Circuit case. But the Burks concurring opinion said that under their precedence, had the government proved that 99% of the letters reaching the mailroom were delivered to U.S. mails, the evidence was still have fallen short establishing guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, we have the Miller case, which is really attenuated. I mean, just as, okay, you have two options, mail, don't mail. If you don't show evidence of the don't mail option, then the check is mailed.
Delivering mail.
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think that's really bad. I'm sorry, with due respect to the court, it's long gone, 1982. But I think the great thing about this court is that in Chung Lo, this very court had, in Chung Lo, had adopted the, I don't know if the holding, but it adopted the analysis that was espoused in Hannigan. I have to say this. What the judge said in Burks was the following. This is the conclusion. I hope that the government will be more careful with its proof over this decision as to when to bring mail fraud charges. If it is, the problem, for the most part, will go away. And I think that's what we need here. We need something more than just this pre-audit manager from DAGS coming in to testify, which he could, up to a certain point, and then, bam, we don't know what happened to that check. Your Honor, there's so many other issues. I would like to touch briefly on the qualifications of the expert witness as well as the restitution issue. Your Honor, very briefly, I think I tried to brief the issue of the expert's lack of qualifications. I asked the court to take a look at the Smith-Kline case that we have cited. Now, Smith-Kline, admittedly, Your Honors, is a it's not a Ninth Circuit case, and it's not even a court of appeals case. It's a district court case. But I think the analysis of Smith-Kline is appropriate because the facts come so close to our case. We're talking about contractors. We're talking about Mr. Furukawa, Mr. Uemura, who chose not to appeal, and the other contractors who were found guilty or entered plea bargains where they didn't have any conviction at all. They all ended up with deferrals, as far as I know, which means that they could obviously ultimately dismiss the charges against them. But in the Smith-Kline case, Your Honor, Smith-Kline talked about two contractors. This was a motion in limine ruling, allowing in the testimony of these two contractors because the two contractors, roofing contractors, had the background. They did approximately three, one of them, high grade, did approximately 300 appraisals a year. I'm running out of time. But the point is, the Smith-Kline case did say that this is the appropriate way to determine what the bid should be. If you look at Mr. Goldblatt's testimony, what he was proffered for, his qualifications as a construction consultant does not qualify him for this type of bidding work.
What's our standard review for admitting his testimony?
Clearly erroneous, I would say. Yeah. It's true, Your Honor. I mean, I realize that I'm up against a heavy burden, but it doesn't mean that it's a burden that should be minimized. Your Honor, the thing that I'm really concerned about is now I'm going to talk about what happened at sentencing, but Mr. Goldblatt's participation in the sentencing is important because on the unreviewed matters of contracts or the billings that were put before the judge, in which the judge did agree that were part of the restitution order, Mr. Furukawa had to pay an additional $3,933,616.79. This was just put out there in summary fashion. We don't even know who these investigators were. They took this number, threw it against the wall, see if it would stick, and it did, Your Honor.
Are you talking about the costs of the investigation?
No, that's another thing. That was a visual
issue.
Yeah, that's
you're talking about the contract itself.
Yes, Your Honor. The contracts that were not reviewed.
Because he wasn't qualified to talk about the structural ones as opposed to the smaller amounts?
Yeah, no, that's part of it, Your Honor. But I'm saying that even if Mr. Furukawa, Mr. Hirokawa, Mr. Okada should have been held responsible for restitution in the amount of the contracts went under review, they were also held responsible for additional number of contracts. that were not reviewed. And that amounts to
$3,933,006.
I think it's clear error beyond any doubt here. I think it's really clear error. I'm much more confident. I'm not going to minimize the rest of it. I'm outraged. And Mr. Hirakawa, I need to speak, if I speak for them, I'm running short of time, but he had over $4 million, as did Mr. Okada. Now, I need to say this very quickly. In the Scrivener and Watson cases that were cited by the government, Scrivener was a telemarketing fraud, Watson was a telephone cloning case. In those cases, these are pure crooks. They went out there to victimize elderly people. That's Mr. Scrivener and his son, telemarketing fraud. Watson victimized people by
use of... victimized here, the public, didn't they?
But they had the benefit, Your Honor, of the work. None of the jobs was not completed. The issue is, well, probably...
They were a little high, but they got the benefit.
They were high. Yes, Your Honor. I'm not going to suggest that they were not.
Okay.
I'm not going to suggest that there was not, you know, fraud in the... complimentary bids. But what I'm saying is that they went forward, they did every job that they were assigned to do, and the state got the benefit of their work. Don't forget, the airport was in very bad condition, and these gentlemen did perform, albeit at a value, excessive perhaps, but that wasn't the issue, as I stated in my brief. The issue is whether the expert was qualified to talk about bids as opposed to value. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Larry Tong. I'm an assistant United States attorney representing the government. I was also trial counsel in this matter. I say that only because I very much enjoyed my friend's argument, in part because it was a replay of the trial arguments that were made. But as Judge Brunetti points out, we are here on appeal now, and I think the court is duty-bound to apply a somewhat deferential standard of review, in many cases even plain error review. With regard to the mail fraud convictions on the sufficiency of the evidence, of course, the standard is highly deferential. The question for this court to decide is simply whether any rational jury could have found that the elements were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I submit to your honors that the evidence was not only sufficient, but actually overwhelming. We called the manager of the very department, which was responsible for the very payment of the checks in question. She testified, in Judge Brunetti's words, to the routine custom and practice used by the department, something that is acceptable per the prior decisions of the circuit, which established that direct proof of the mailing, the use of an eyeball witness, the person to testify that there was a stamp physically affixed to the envelope is not needed. And in this case, we not only went through the custom and practice of the department, but we had the actual documents. Even though those documents were years before the events in question, Exhibit 68 of the government's exhibits, a portion of which appears at page 221 of the supplemental excerpts of record, we had a document generated with regard to each of the checks at issue with the clerk's notation that each of those checks was to be mailed. Now, that was adequate from which the jury could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the checks were mailed, but to the extent anyone wants to toss out the need for eyeball testimony, I might just note in passing that we also had the cooperating contractors in this case who provided testimony about the conspiracy and the scheme to defraud, and we asked each of them, by the way, when you engaged in this conduct, how did you get paid? And they said, by check. We said, well, how did you get the check? They said through the mail, the United States mail. The specific references there are appear on page 51 of the government's brief, I believe, in a footnote. So when you put it all together on a sufficiency review, the evidence was more than adequate to support the assertion that each of the checks in question was mailed. There are many issues here. I think we've addressed most of them in our brief. I think Mr. Luke was trying to hit on many of them. I don't know if the court has particular questions or issues it would like me to address. Otherwise, we're
Willingness. Counsel admitted he was not going to dispute that there was fraud in the complimentary bid, so that kind of knocks out some of those issues right there.
I noticed that. That was a bit different from the trial proceedings, yeah. But certainly it appears that he's now admitting the fraud, and his challenge now seems to be to the sufficiency of the proof of the mailings, presumably because he thinks that's the way to get rid of the entire
case.
Well,
he also mentions the expert about the expert. It sounds to me, when I read the briefs, that they wanted an expert that would be doing the same kind of bidding precisely as in airports, the problems getting in and out of the airport, et cetera, et cetera. But again, we're under standard of review here. The question is, how do we judge what the district judge did in allowing that testimony in? At our level on the standard of review.
That's right, Your Honor. I think it was well within his discretion to allow the expert to testify. The expert was certainly qualified in the area in which he offered testimony. There clearly was relevance, as we pointed out in the indictment. We allege, number one, there was a fraud that existed through the use of the complimentary bids, which Mr. Luke apparently has admitted today for the first time to this court.
For purposes of appeal, he's conceding.
For purposes of appeal.
This argument, yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
Contesting.
Yes, Your Honor, but I just have to remind him of it, because I'll remind him after this argument that this is the first time I've heard him say that.
Well, there are certain things that the district court has settled and you can't really successfully appeal. You may still think the district court was wrong to do that, but it's not appropriate for appeal.
Right. I agree, Your Honor. The one thing I would emphasize is the district court here performed its gatekeeping function with regard to the expert. He started out, quite frankly, Judge Ezra did, without knowing specifically what jobs the expert was going to opine on, saying, well, you don't have the expertise in the specific requirements on airports, such as building tarmacs, building runways, complying with engineering criteria that might be unique to that kind of Department of Transportation facility. And when it was all said and done, what he allowed Mr. Goldblatt to testify was to those minor non-structural repairs, the cost of which, the performance of which would be the same regardless of their location. In other words, whether it be repairing ceramic tile in the courthouse or in a public bathroom or in the airport, the location wouldn't matter. There are industry standards that are used, which Mr. Goldblatt relied upon.
These were type of, it seems to me they were all these particular contractors were all pushed into this level of repair work, which, as you said, tile generic stuff. It wasn't like electronics and airport stuff. So as I remember, Goldblatt had extensive history in the construction industry and management, bidding, and whatever. So he was used to find out what the reasonable value of these services was. I read the record.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. He had 40 years in the construction industry, beginning as a teenager working for his dad doing small repair work, continuing as a contractor in another state, not in Hawaii, and also doing project management here in Hawaii. Interestingly, one of his assignments had been to work as the manager for the state of Hawaii housing authority in the repair of 350-some homes, many of which required the same kind of repairs that were done here. And he applied that expertise. Of course, this is not a scientific field subject to peer review analysis, although their brief referenced that in portions of, I think, the Kumho tire case, rather. This is a situation where you can look at his practical experience in the field, which the court did very carefully.
Yeah. Counsel does bring up the issue of the damages, indicating that there were some in the methodology in which they adopted, that Judge Ezra adopted, the final damages.
Again, Your Honor, he adopted the findings. Well, he adopted the recommendations of the pre-sentence report with regard to the relevant conduct for which each conspirator should be held accountable. There's nothing wrong with that. This Court has said that adopting the factual findings of the pre-sentence report suffices to discharge the district court's obligation. With regard to the loss methodology,
that's what I'm talking about.
Again. I think I'm answering your question backwards, but again, Your Honor, that is consistent with the two cases. I believe they're Watson and Shrivner.
I don't think either of those cases supports the notion that if there's proof that no loss occurred, that you can demand restitution for that. Your expert, whose qualifications you just discussed in some detail,
yes,
said there were six contracts that were underbid, right?
He didn't say underbid. He wasn't allowed to use those words. And actually what he said is he didn't have sufficient knowledge going back after the fact to determine the precise scope of the work. So what he did in, with regard to those six contracts is assume the worst case scenario, even though it would understate.
You're saying about the expert or the judge?
The expert. In other words, Your Honor, there were some jobs that he looked at.
Right. We have six that we did in the record.
Right.
There's no proof of that there was overbidding.
No, but that was factored into the percentage of loss that
wasn't
in
the. That's saying that between 68 and 90, and therefore we're going to do 68 for all of the contracts, even the ones that we have no proof on. How can you sustain that?
Okay, well, there's two issues there, Your Honor. First off, I think that the cases that I referenced earlier stand for the proposition that you can use a methodology that will derive a reasonable estimate of the loss. That's under the guidelines.
Sure.
As well as
there's
case.
No question about that. And you can't just say that and then say, well, this is reasonable because we put up percentages. And
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I'm just trying to proceed in a manner. How do I get from point A to the end result? So we tried to give the court a methodology by which it could come up with a reasonable estimate. Now, what we had here is we had the two categories of reviewed documents, one category being the reviewed documents or contracts that were specifically referenced in the indictment. We came up with a specific loss that was applied with regard to those contracts. Those contracts, I think, were, according to the expert, 90% overbuilt. In other words, the value of the work reasonably was 10% of the amounts that were actually paid.
That was 68 to 90%.
The first category of contracts referenced in the indictment, it was 90%. The second category of documents or contracts, small purchase contracts that were reviewed, also related to the co-conspirators, but were not specifically identified in the indictment. The loss amounts there represented 68%. Of the total billed amounts. So what the court did, what probation did, what the court adopted, what we agreed with, is essentially we took the most conservative estimate, in other words, the estimate most favorable to the defendants, the 68% amount, and applied it to the universe of the contracts. The universe of the contracts were submitted.
Well, maybe the most conservative in terms of the percentage, but in terms of the actual amount ordered for restitution, it was greater, wasn't it?
It becomes greater because the universe is greater.
You really can't say that it's the most conservative approach as to the defendants when, if you add in everything else, including the universe of questionable contracts, it ends up in more restitution ordered than would have been the case had you just simply done 90% and 68%.
That's right, Your Honor. But one of the issues is relevant conduct, and you look at the jointly undertaking criminal activity. And in this case, if I may, I mean what we have here is a group of defendants and other co-conspirators who knowingly submitted bids that were inflated through the use of these complementary false bids. We showed a pattern of the use of the false.
I'm granting all
no,
that.
But Your Honor, I'm going a step further because if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, what you're saying is that we should limit ourselves to the reviewed contracts, whatever they may be. And what I'm saying is we knew that there were more than that. We knew that because as it has been offered today for purposes of appeal only, we proved up the fraud. So now we go a step further and we say, well, during the exact time period of the conspiracy that was alleged, what were the total amounts of the contracts that were awarded to those who participated in the fraud?
Well, is there some reason those other contracts couldn't have been reviewed by somebody also?
Money. Money. It
well,
cost.
They might have been worth spending the money to get it back.
Well, Your Honor, with all respect, I mean, these are small jobs and I can't remember the figure, but Mr. Luke actually would probably remember better than I because he cross-examined. I think Mr. Goldblatt incurred about $100,000 in fees just doing the work that he did do. And each of these contracts, by definition, I think Judge Brunetti said that they were left to small jobs. By definition, they're small purchase contracts, having a value of $25,000 or less, even at the inflated amounts. And if Your Honors look at Government's Exhibit 1, which appears at SER page 1, I think we have a total of millions of dollars. It simply was not possible to go out and review each and every $25,000 contract to derive a specific number.
Does the law require that?
I don't believe the law does require
But they're arguing about six contracts that Mr. Goldblatt did look at.
I don't believe they're arguing about six contracts. I believe they're arguing about the entire universe. And my response, Your Honor, to that was just that Mr. Goldblatt went back, and if he felt that he couldn't ascertain the specific amount of work that was to be done, then he would assume the most favorable interpretation to them. To give an example, if there were to be a scratch to be repaired on wood, and he would go to the site, and the repairs would be here in this courtroom, the scratch could be 1 inch long, or it could be they had to refurbish every piece of wood in this contract. And he testified, well, in those circumstances, I assume the entire thing was refurbished. And those are specifically the types of categories for the six contracts to which Your Honor refers, where he says, well, making those assumptions, I'm going to say the value is even greater than what they actually built. And what I'm suggesting to Your Honor, as Judge Brunetti seems to be implying, you don't have to go through a case-by-case analysis on each of these.
Well, isn't there a representative contract that could be taken for each group?
It was not a statistically valid sampling, if that's what Your Honor means with regard to representative. They're representative in the sense that they fit in the same categories, i.e., small purchase contracts, $25,000 or less, supported by the same bidding practice that proved the underlying fraud. In other words, the use of each other's companies for the bids and the use of the four companies that we proved were submitting bids repeatedly without getting a job and whose principals essentially got up and said, we never bid on that and we had no intention of bidding on that. And I think there were some 400 bids, I don't have the specific number, from those companies during the conspiracy, which resulted in zero jobs.
Well, I think we're reviewing for clear air here. And if the methodology that the judge used, and using the pre-sentence report and the expert, is clear error, then it all should go out. If there wasn't clear error in the sense of selecting the methodology and the expert, then his final determination on the amount is also clear error. So where do we look? In other words, you've given us the process. You know, it was too much money, blah, blah, blah. And so if there could be a process used, which is, if you're going to use the Scrivener formula, if you will, and if you throw things together, and if the expert uses that process and makes adjustments, and the judge listens to those adjustments and adopts them, then there's got to be clear error somewhere.
I think to the contrary, I don't think that is clear.
No, I'm saying there's got to be clear air somewhere, or else we've got to leave it alone.
I would agree. And that's
is that
what,
your position?
Yes, Your Honor. And in terms of where do you look, well, frankly, you look first to whether the expert testimony could have been admitted for purposes of liability. I think on appeal, abuse of discretion, clearly it was properly used. Then in terms of loss, it becomes the Scribner situation coupled together with the standards of the guidelines, which is reasonable estimate using taking into account all available information.
And I take it your position, too, as I remember, was that your position is that the appellant is taking a global look at this, if you will, and saying not there's only six contracts that are wrong, go back and redo the six, but the global application is wrong. Is that what you're saying?
I think that the six simply shows that he acted in good faith in terms of making his estimation, and I think those amounts get factored in with the others, which derives a multiplier that can reasonably, under the law, be used to apply to the universe.
But if you just took the six, the answer would be zero restitution, right?
If you just took the six, but he reviewed...
But here is his testimony that as to these six contracts, there's no overbilling, zero.
For those six contracts?
Right.
Yes.
So, but as to those six contracts, he ordered restitution in the calculations, correct?
I don't believe we ordered restitution as to those six specific contracts. I don't believe it was that specific. What it was is, what was the overall law?
Know.
We know because we know the methodology that was used. The methodology that was used is...
Well, as I understand what the district court said, and maybe you can correct me, is that, well, we've got 68 to 90, and so we're going to apply 68 across the board to everything, including the six contracts.
Oh, I misapprehended Your Honor's question. Okay.
Yeah, the six contracts for which the expert said there was zero money that should have been owed if we took them all out are included in the 68%, right? So My problem is, if we have clear evidence in the record, I understand the general methodology, mm-hmm. and it might be fairest to the contract, but if the expert says, even being generous, and I understand your point on that, that there was no overbilling on those contracts, how can we order restitution for it?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good point as to six particular contracts. But what I'm saying is the methodology.
Well, that was my only question.
I apologize. I misunderstood your question. Yeah. I frankly misunderstood.
But the district court included them. There's no evidence to support that. And so even under clear error, how do we include those?
Because we employed a methodology which basically was essential under the reasonable estimate provisions of the guidelines. You know what the universe is. You go to it. I don't know that. I could be wrong. I don't know that he was asked to carve out six specific contracts at the time of trial.
Well, if we throw out the six, then we got to throw out everything that weren't given enough. Because if there were some contracts that were 90% overbid and they only got 68%, there's a problem there, too.
Well, that's right, Your Honor.
And the methodology seems to subsume them. But I'm missing something here. No. Were those six contracts that are being disputed talked about? Under one contractor, two contractors, a bunch of contractors, I don't remember.
My recollection is that most of those contracts were with a company called Ken Lee Limited Liability Corporation. And
okay, is the record also sure that Ken Lee might have got overpaid on some of them?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In fact, we had direct testimony about when Ken Lee did, if I can elaborate.
I mean, in the process of the 68-90.
Oh, overpaid, yes, very much so.
That's the whole purpose of the process. In other words, you may submit 15 contracts. 15 may be under, 15 may be over. Or 30, 15 may be under, and you submit 15, it may be under. They put them all together and came up with 68. Now, that's the process. The process is either wrong or right.
That's
as I understand your theory.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think it's right. And
may I ask you a question? I thought that 68 to 90 was based on the contracts that were examined that were overbilled, correct?
No.
No, I mean, basically, if there were overbilling on the contract, the average overbilling was, that they saw was 68 to 90%.
That's correct, okay. Your Honor. And I believe
So did you take into consideration in the examination of 68 to 90 those that were not overbilled?
Yes.
How so?
Of the contracts that Mr. Goldblatt reviewed, they included the six where he said that there was no overbilling, and those are part of the subset, which are about 256 contracts.
I understand that, but I mean, he didn't in concluding 68%. He was just lumping the six in with everything.
Yeah, he did a mathematical averaging of all, and I think that's.
You're saying that in reaching the 68 to 90, he considered in reaching that figure those contracts where there was no overbilling,
yes,
as well as those where there were. If he had just taken the ones that were overbilled, he would have reached a higher figure than 68.
Yes, Ron. He considered the six.
Are you sure
as
about
to
that in the record?
Can
you
yet? Okay. Can I point to it? Well, it's in the, I don't have an SER reference, but it's in the charts, the spreadsheets that we introduced, because at trial he testified.
Well, I did look at the spreadsheets, and I didn't see the zero in there.
Well, I can assure the court that when he testified about those contracts as to which he concluded there was no overbilling, because he was cross-examined on it, otherwise it wouldn't be in the record. And those are part of the 200-some contracts that he specifically reviewed. And if I may make one point, I see my time is out, but on review, one thing I should point out is our loss calculations using this procedure, I think, came in at about $3.6 million. You would have to reduce it all the way to $2.5 million before you could find that a lower guideline range would apply. So even if six of those contracts were eliminated using the court suggestion, at a maximum of $25,000 per contract, you're talking of $150,000, which would
be the amount of restitution, but not the guideline sentence.
Absolutely.
I guess your time's up, but if you could answer in 30 to 60 seconds, how you charge for the entire Attorney General's investigation? Wasn't the criminal case?
Of course this is a criminal case. Your Honor, I have to say that the record is silent. And to a certain degree, this falls back on who suffers from the lack of factual development. I know the court suffers, but in terms of the parties, whose burden it was to develop the record. There was never an objection to the inclusion of restitution to the state for the investigative costs. The Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, of course, requires that all direct and foreseeable costs be awarded to a victim, and that's what happened here. And in the absence of an objection, we never developed the record. I know, as a representative of the government sitting here today, what the answer is, but it's not in the record.
Are there any other cases in which the restitutions, including the cost of the Attorney General's investigation in connection with a criminal case?
You mean in this particular case?
No, in general.
I'm not aware of any, but this was a unique case where the State Attorney General started prosecuting some of the co-conspirators, as reflected by the record, and then brought these four individuals over for federal prosecution. But the record does not reflect what portion of those costs that were awarded, $600-some thousand, were for the gathering of information as a direct and foreseeable consequence of the offense, as opposed to gathering it for criminal prosecution.
Again, we're reviewing for plain error on this, aren't we?
We're reviewing for plain error, and I don't think that they can show that the sentence either was clearly illegal or that there was plain error, where no objection was made such that we could respond with evidence in the district court at a time when it would have been meaningful.
Thank you,
counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, may it please the court, Mr. Tong.
Could you take 30 seconds to answer the last question?
Yes, Your Honor. I wrote an extensive sentencing memorandum. I submitted the total advisory guideline loss should be $364,817, or at most $1,398,000. I don't believe, Your Honor, that what Mr. Tong is speaking about, the investigative costs, are anything other than plain error. This is what the judge did at sentencing, admittedly. I didn't harp on that when I initially argued, because $689,685 pales in comparison to the unreviewed contracts. I mean, my client and the other clients, the other defendants, you know, were held responsible for almost $4 million that were unreviewed. That's my response, Your Honor. I think it is plain error.
Well, sure, it's plain error review, but, I mean, why then should we consider it now on plain error review? Why do you succeed on plain error review on the restitution of investigative costs?
Because that came up at sentencing. They were held responsible for that amount at sentencing, not before the jury. The judge decided that. I objected to that. I made my argument as to the Honorable Judge David Ezra as to what the amount should have been. He disagreed, and he just adopted the findings of the pre-sentence report, which I clearly objected.
But if he objected, why is it plain error?
Well,
there's a clear error review, which is clearly erroneous, but plain is...
I'm sorry, it's clearly erroneous, Your Honor, because I did object to it.
You did object.
Yes, Your Honor. It's in my sentencing memorandum. I made my objections to the PSR, the pre-sentence report.
But Mr. Tong indicated that if you'd made an objection, you would have come forward with more evidence. And you say you didn't make an objection.
Well, let me put it this way, Your Honor. I filed a sentencing memorandum that consisted of 19 pages. Mr. Tong simply had no objections to the pre-sentence investigation report. It's my sentencing memorandum, Your Honors, is part of the record. And it's starting at page 6. I do have objections to the pre-sentence report, including the offense conduct, the amount that was determined to be compensable as restitution, the advisory guideline computation, which was driven by the amount of restitution, Your Honor.
Did you specifically object to the $689,685 to the Department of Transportation?
Frank, there's a terrible way to answer the question. I don't know, Your Honor. I looked specifically at what was attributable to my client, and I said this is how much he should be held accountable for. By not specifically objecting, Your Honor, yes, my answer would be yes. I just want to say one last thing. Yes, I when I said that there was evidence of fraud in the complimentary bids, it's clear that, you know, that there were fake bids that were put out in the attempt to obtain the award for the work that was bid for. However, I also argued, and I think in our briefs we argued the good faith reliance. I submit to your court, to your honors, do what you will with that, but I think the evidence is that there was layers of review from people who actually looked at this and approved and adopted these bids that were submitted by all defendants. There was verification, approval of work performed. There was a certification of the work performed. There was a recommendation for payment. There was further certification and verification of work performed. And this is not simply just on the bids itself, looking at the work and seeing that the work and invoice was correct in every respect by an Hayashi, that the goods and services were rendered. So I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that there is a place for the good faith reliance by our clients on the approval by the state of Hawaii.
Can you clarify your restitution argument for me? Are you arguing to exclude six transactions, or are you using the six transactions to argue that the calculation methodology on the unexamined contracts should go back?
Yes, the latter, Your Honor. Obviously,
you want to state that clearly, please. The
yes,
latter, what?
Yes, there were His Honor was asking about. There were at least six contracts that were determined by Mr. Goldblatt to have been underbid. Actually, it's not that the government. This wasn't a matter of just having a wash. It's that the government benefited because they were so undervalued. I'm sorry, I can't say where they are in the briefs right now, but it's clearly in the record. Your Honor, it's absolutely right that this is absolutely...
So they're underbid, so what? So what's wrong?
So then the unreviewed contracts make no account of the high likelihood, the great probability that there was work performed that was either within the range of, I'm going to use Mr. Goldblatt's term, value of the work performed, or that the state had the benefit of a grossly underbid piece of work.
Or it's highly likely that there was a bunch of them that were overbid. That's
yes.
Why they used the formula of 68%. So I think what you're questioning then is the whole process.
I am, Your Honor.
Because of the six, it shows that the process was flawed.
That's correct. Yeah, the process was clearly flawed. And not only for that reason, Your Honor. They weren't reviewed. Now,
you would agree, though, as I understand it, then, with the government, that the six contracts you've been talking about were included in the 60% computation. In other words, that would be zero or some benefit. But those, for whatever percentage was involved in those contracts for value, would have been included in the calculation that resulted in a minimum of 68, maximum 90.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I know I knew the answer to that because I really studied this. I'm not sure. I'm terribly sorry I can't answer that.
What if the record shows that they were?
Well, I still think the methodology was erroneous.
Again, I understand that, but if the records show that they were, then you're still questioning the 68% methodology.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because you have unreviewed contracts, you don't know what they are, they could be up, they could be down.
Absolutely right.
Okay.
And Your Honor, please, as I stated, this is not a Scrivener and a Watson type of case. This is not a case of pure unmitigated theft or taking advantage of senior citizens in a telemarketing fraud with absolutely no benefit to those individuals. We're talking about bids for work that was performed by licensed contractors, perhaps overvalued. I mean, the evidence is pretty solid there. But nevertheless, the work was done in many cases.
But the work, I mean, so if there's a fraudulent overcharge, so what that it's not elderly citizens.
Because
where we are going with this argument, if the evidence is that it was overcharged by, let's say, 50%, whatever
yes.
the percentage is.
Yes. This is my response, Your Honor. In the Scrivener case, you're talking about a methodology that was used, and Mr. Tong says, well, take a look at these cases. Look what they did in those cases, which was approved by the Ninth Circuit. However, in those cases, the number that's extrapolated, the manner in which restitution was determined to be appropriate, involved pretty clear and simple fraudulent practices without the possibility of any benefit to the victim, without the possibility that not only did the victim benefit, but benefited to the extent that it was, you know, that the contractors themselves lost money.
But why isn't that concern taken care of by the percentage? In other words, you still have either 10% or on up a percent of value left. If you've been tagged with the whole loss, I can understand your argument. But it wasn't the point of doing a percentage, the idea of retaining value or estimating some value to the work performed and not requiring your clients to be ordered restitution on that?
In a sense, yes, Your Honor, but it's different. It's different because there's no evidence about what was done in these contracts. I'm very uncomfortable with just throwing the 68%, extrapolated from a very small sample and applying it to a great number of unreviewed contracts. Also, Mr. Tong's statement, well, not enough money, Your Honor. You can't pay enough for justice. I think it's a disingenuous argument. I don't think it would be very difficult. If you look at Mr. Goldblatt, he just looked at photographs, and he was wrong. We had witnesses that testified in trial, and they're part of the record, that say that, no, you need to do more for Terrazzo. Asphalt curbing, he never considered.
That all went to the jury.
That all went to the jury, so I'm not arguing that. But what I'm saying is it goes to the restitution. It goes to when the methodology that was used by Mr. Goldblatt is applied, the 68% comes out of Mr. Goldblatt. I mean, it's based upon Mr. Goldblatt's evaluations. If his methodology is faulty, there's no possibility of the 68%.
You're just saying the judge made a clear error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
The case to be argued will be submitted. The court will take a brief recess.